Even on a budget, quality is non-negotiable. That's why Quince is the place to score high-end essentials at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Get your hands on buttery soft cashmere sweaters from just $60, Italian leather jackets, and so much more. And the best part about Quince, they exclusively partner with factories committed to safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Elevate your style without the elevated price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Ever Googled your own name? Prepare for a shock because your personal info, including addresses and phone numbers, is out there, especially with the recent hacks at some big phone and healthcare companies. But here's where Aura steps in. Aura scans the dark web for your sensitive information and sends real-time alerts. Aura also actively requests that your information be removed from data broker sites, putting you back in control. Aura provides you with a complete online safety toolkit, credit and transaction monitoring, a secure password manager, a privacy-enhancing VPN, and more. Try Aura risk-free with a 14-day trial at aura.com/safety. That's aura.com/safety. Rest easy with Aura. Visit aura.com/safety today.
Hello, I'm Matt Chorley, and this is Politics Without the Boring Bits. It's a brand new look for the Red Box podcast. All the same features, but now with my big fat face on the logo. On today's episode, who are the big political winners and losers of 2023? The Columnist's festive focus group separates the wheat from the chaff. And all this year, Lara Spirit has been counting down every general election since the Great Reform Act of 1832, while she's been in the Times archive. Today, she brings us some election lessons and pointers for what will be a big election year in 2024. And if you like what you hear here, you can join me for Politics Without the Boring Bits live on Times Radio, on your DAB radio, on your smart speaker, or download the Times Radio app. Politics Without the Boring Bits, weekdays from 10. We start with some breaking news. More revelations about Michelle Mohn, the Tory Baroness at the centre of the PPE scandal. Michelle Mohn now has denied trying to sabotage the sheep costumes in the Nativity.
I wasn't trying to pull the wool over anyone's eyes.
The other thing that struck me watching Michelle Mohn moan.
My family have gone through hell with the media.
Oh, I mean, could that be because you kept lying to the media and even threatening journalists with aggressive legal letters while they asked questions about something you knew to be true, that you were involved in the company that made all this money? Anyway, the other thing that struck me was not that we don't all have so much money that we can tuck away a spare £30 million in a trust or on the Isle of Man or hide our involvement in businesses from the public available register. No, the thing that struck me watching the interview on Laura Koonsberg's show yesterday on BBC One, Michelle Mohn, is her husband, Derek Bowerman's shirt. Now, this is a man with a huge amount of money, mind-boggling amounts of money. Yet his shirt looked like mine after a particularly heavy Sunday carvery. It was gaping, doesn't come close. I was worried at one point a button might fly off and blind Laura Koonsberg. Why doesn't he buy another one? He could afford a new shirt, a shirt that fit. He could probably afford to have one made. Or he could just pop on one of the millions of gowns he sold to the British government, which have never been used.
The Columnists.
Yeah, it's a very special treat. Normally, at this time, you hear from just two of our columnists. But all this week, we've got a Times Columnists festive focus group where we're going to get James Marriott, Robert Crampton, Alice Thompson, Matthew Bell, Libby Purvis and Manveen Rana taking us through what's happened in 2023, the highs, the lows, how they're spending Christmas, the weirdness of how some of them don't buy many Christmas presents. But today we kick off with the political winners and losers of the year. And starting it all off, here's Alice Thompson.
I've got two, if that's possible. I've got Penny Morden with her sword, because we've all forgotten her, but she really rocked it at the coronation.
The sword of state, which is the heaviest sword, so I've been doing some press-ups to train for that.
And then I've got Lord Cameron of Chipping Norton, who I feel has had a spectacular comeback and we thought had disappeared to the country and pony clubs and really obscurity in his shepherd's hut. and has now come back and is now trailing the world with these dignitaries and may yet get another job.
Right, very good. Libby, who was your political winner of the year?
I think, actually, I'm being controversial here, I think Rishi Sunak for being less repellent than anybody else at the investigation.
I just wanted to start by saying how deeply sorry I am.
Bravely standing up for himself over his Eat Out to Help Out, which was 12 feeble days in April and made no difference to anything, and he's being picked on for it. So I want to give him just a sort of, not a large kind of winner's cup, but a kind of small...
A small one. Small, I'll be honest, he's not a big man. He'll be happy with a little trophy.
Listen, I saw last night, I saw Pandemonium, the... Amanda Iannucci send-up of the whole 4 years, which there was a magnificent Rishi in that. And I think I would like to give a small, and again, I don't want to give any big wins because I haven't been any big wins. I want to give quite a small cup to Danny Kruger.
Everything must conform at last to the imagining of John Lennon.
For having written a book suggesting that he has actual moral principles and everybody else ought to have some too. So that was kind of novel.
Robert Crampton, your winner of the year.
I've got three, Matt.
Oh, God! Can't somebody just have one?
As little Keir Mather.
I'm really looking forward to showing what a Labour MP can get done in a seat in, like Selby and Ainsley from day one.
Who won the Selby by-election back in September, and I had the pleasure of interviewing him. I think he's going to go far, even though he's probably going to lose his seat in the next election. There is Pat McFadden, who's been popping up on, who I know of old from his days as a Blairite apparatchik, I suppose, who's been popping up and always very impressive on the TV.
I'm here in Wolverhampton in support of Pat McFadden. Pat is a great guy.
And there's Paul Kagame, the president of Rwanda, who, who has just pocketed £300 million from the British taxpayer and lectured us about the importance of the rule of law, despite having at least 10 political opponents and critics assassinated since he became president. So that's pretty good going. 300 million quid and keeps moral high ground. Marvellous.
I mean, what a trio. What a trio. Pat McFadden, Keir Mather and Paul Kagame. Right, Matthew Bell, I assume you're going to have four winners of the year.
I've got about six, but I'll limit it to, let's say, two. I think one of them must be Eddie Izzard. I'm very excited by his campaign running for Brighton in a pink two-piece dress. I think that's going to be very exciting. And the other one is Peter Mandelson. I think it's very exciting that he's quietly coming back, orchestrating Labour policy from behind the scenes for the next election. So I think...
If I can come back, we can come back!
Those are my two ones to watch for 2020.
Well, as a result of his emergence as a podcast star, of course, Peter Manson will have to win.
When I'm talking about podcasters, those are the other ones. Rory Stewart, you know, quietly assassinated with his new book and his brilliant podcast. And George Osborne and Ed Balls. I mean, I'm not sure about that one, but, you know.
Nobody listens to that one. Nobody listens to that one.
It's like TV news.
Manveen, talking of winners from podcasts, Manveen Rana, who is your winner in politics?
I mean,
this
I have
year?
To say, this game gets harder as you go around the table, because I was going to go for both Cameron and Kagame, because I think they've probably won at politics. But also, I think... And this just sort of proves it. They don't have to be winners you want. But I think Nigel Farage somehow has managed to get to the end of this year, and people are talking about him making the biggest political comeback, bigger than David Cameron's. And the idea that he might still somehow work, you know, sort of rule the future of the Tory Party is absolutely astonishing.
You all laughed at me. Well, I have to say, you're not laughing now, are you?
From a man who was sort of in the political wilderness a few months back.
Very good, very good. James Marriott, your political winners in 2023.
Can I say the king? Spent his entire life waiting to be king.
He's done.
This is kind of politics, and he was finally crowned this year.
And he, I think, and also, you know, he was quite political at the height of Rishi Sunak and the Greek prime minister, the king wearing a tie with the Greek flag on it and then going, oh, what, this old thing? No, it was just a coincidence.
made a speech at COP.
Yeah.
Has a homeopathic advisor, we learned today. I mean, that's pretty, you know, it's a pretty successful year.
Made a speech at COP after being banned from doing that last year. So it feels like this has been a good year for him.
That's a good point. OK, so that's your winners. Let's do your losers of the year now. James, you can go first.
Phew. Well, okay, it's good because I've got a very obvious one, who is Nicola Sturgeon.
The last few days have been obviously difficult, quite traumatic at times.
Who was, you know, beloved of centrist dads only a year ago, and then had a fall from grace with dodgy caravan dealings and was arrested, which is just kind of got to be one of the remarkable downward political trajectories of our time in how suddenly it happened and how kind of unexpectedly it suddenly, you know, just sort of erupted out of nowhere. It was really fascinating to watch.
Very good. Very good. Manveen, your loser of the year.
I agree with James. I think that it's like a Greek tragedy, you know, the complete turn.
It's incredible.
To start from the year, you know, being sort of Lord and Master of Worship of Aid and suddenly being arrested and bringing down the party with her. Similarly, though, slightly left field, but I would say Prigozhin started the year pretty well. Didn't end so well for him, after all.
What with being dead?
What with being dead? what happened to the Wagner Group? So, again, sort of like, not a great year for him, it turns out.
Yeah, well, you know, some people would say starting the year alive and ending it dead is a sign that the year has not gone well. Matthew Bell, your pick of your loser of the year.
Well, it would have to be Matt Hancock, because the great tragedy of his life is that he went on I'm a Celebrity, Get Me Out of Here last year, revived his political career, only for the COVID inquiry to then scupper it once again. So he's gone, done the snakes and ladders of going back to the top, and now he's back at the bottom again.
He was, quote, loving responsibility, and to demonstrate this, took up a batsman's stance outside the cabinet room and said, they bowl them at me, I knock them away.
And then he had to eat pig's anuses on top of that.
And then got shouted at by the SAS people as well, in a very amusing way. Robert, your loser of the year.
I'd go with James Cleverly. He started the year swanning around the world, being, by all accounts, a reasonably successful foreign secretary in a pretty good job. And then he finds himself in the worst job in government, impossible job, Home Secretary. And then he gets pinged for referring to Stockton in the northeast as a not a very nice place in the Commons.
I did not, would not.
You did.
Then what are you calling me, sir?
So he's from somebody who hadn't really done anything much wrong. He's gone down a very long snake, hasn't he?
Very good. Alice, who was your loser of the year?
I think I'm going to give a triumvirate of women, actually. So I thought Liz Truss's best friend, Theresa Coffey, probably the worst DEFRA secretary we've ever had, to be honest.
You're just throwing comments at me, Kay.
She is gone. So has Nadine Dorris, who hasn't sold any of her books. So I think maybe that's a good thing.
No, I don't think I'll be reading the book. Nadine is a very successful author of fiction, and I'm sure people will see this book in that light.
And also Suella Braverman, who managed to step on a guide dog.
I don't think any dogs were harmed in the filming of my visit, but let me just issue, for the record, an apology to all dogs.
When she was at the Tory Party conference. And so I think probably the loser is the guide dog, who was very well behaved, didn't squeal.
Yeah.
But I'm not sure I would want her heel going into me.
I actually went and did some investigative journalism when that photo emerged of her standing on the guide dog. And I went and tried to, you know, ask the people at the guide dog stand if she really had stood on the guide dog. And they said there was no evidence and the dog didn't react in any way. And I just thought, well, that's maybe because the dog was worried it'd be put on a flight to Rwanda.
And the dog wouldn't be trained not to do anything, wouldn't it? She chose the guide dog.
Yeah, it's a guide dog. It's highly trained.
It's a guide dog. Libby, who was your loser of the year?
I mean, you know, Alice has kind of said it all, really. It's poor old Nadine and my dear MP, Therese Coffey.
Although, to be fair,
she's my MP, remember. I have feelings about the Suffolk.
She's been appalling about sewage in Suffolk.
Well, it's not just the sewage, it's the fact that they want to carve through the entire coast, you know, to bulldoze through some infrastructure stuff, which actually could perfectly well go down to the brownfield sites, you know, on the Thames estuary. But, it's, you know, she kowtowed to the Scottish power profiteers who want to put up enormous substations, and has just been, as an MP, hopeless. But I think nearly everybody could, well, not everybody, but a lot of people could name their MP as the loser of the year.
I know, I have Tractor Porn MP, that's quite good.
Funnily enough, it was tractors that I was looking at.
I think Tractor Porn MP comes quite high up.
And don't forget, you can read the very best political analysis every day in The Times and The Sunday Times. Just get yourself a subscription at thetimes.co.uk.
Rising sea levels, extreme weather patterns, extinctions of species. Our planet needs protecting. I'm Adam Vaughan, the environment editor for The Times, and this is Planet Hope from The Times, in partnership with Rolex and its Perpetual Planet Initiative. In this podcast, we hear from leading experts from around the world who are committed to finding solutions. These explorers, scientists, entrepreneurs, and citizens are committed to a common goal, to protect our home, Earth. Listen now wherever you get your podcasts.
Hey, marketers. Want a matchmaker to set you up with your perfect audience? Well, look no further. Get intimate right away with host-read sponsorships with Acast. Use Acast's self-serve ad platform to search and partner up with a podcaster or two from our network of more than 100,000 shows. Have them sing your praises in their own words. And get their listeners ready to be wooed into loyal customers. It's the ultimate loving endorsement. Book host-read sponsorships with Acast. Head to go.acast.com/closer to get started.
The Big Thing. Spirit in the sky. Oh,
set me up the spirit in the sky. Yes. It's Spirit in the Archive.
Is that how the song goes?
Is that how the song goes, yeah.
I love it. I'll miss it.
I'm going to go to the place that's the best. That is the Times Archive. Lara Spirit is here. She's come straight from the archives where she's been locked up all year, guiding us through every general election since the 1832 Reform Act, which expanded the franchise, which is especially good news if you're a middle-class man, which we all are. But today, Lara, we're going to find out what you've learned during all those hours spent grubbing through the Times Archive. And a little bit of what the parties can learn from history. So these are Lara's lessons. We're kicking off. What's number one, Lara?
On the lessons?
Yes.
Is it that ministers don't usually go early? Or
no,
is it a different one?
The polls can be wrong.
The polls can be wrong.
Yeah. Am I telling you your lessons?
Well, you're telling me which order my lessons are in.
So we're kicking off. So since the beginning of the year,
Of January, we started with 1832 because, as you've just indicated, there was a partial, though not complete, expansion of the franchise and something resembling the parliamentary democracy and election system that we have today, which felt like a fitting time with that great Reform Act to kick off. And ever since, every single week on a Monday, we have looked at how each successive election since then has been covered by The Times in The Times Archive, because The Times has lasted that entire period and has covered every single one of those elections, albeit very differently.
So how many is it altogether? It's about 50.
I'm not sure how many it is altogether.
Anyway, we struggled to fit them all in this year. So, Lara's lesson number one, the polls can be wrong, which is, you know, good news for Rishi Sunak. So let's just remind ourselves a couple of times when the polls are wrong. This was 2015.
But here it is, 10 o'clock, and we are saying the Conservatives are the largest party.
If this exit poll is right, Andrew, I will publicly eat my hat on your programme.
Have you got a hat?
No, but I'll get one, especially.
So, to be clear, the opinion polls had put Labour ahead in 2015. The exit poll showed the Tories doing much better and the Lib Dems facing wipeout. Paddy Ashton, I think, later ate a chocolate hat. And then, in 2017...
And what we're saying is the Conservatives are the largest party. Note, they don't have an overall majority at this stage.
Jeremy Corbyn won an enormous victory in 2017.
No, he didn't. He didn't.
Yes, the biggest victory that Labour had won in a generation.
No, he wasn't. He lost. He didn't become Prime Minister.
That was irresistible.
That was the Tories. Obviously, yeah, we'd been miles ahead in the polls. Theresa May called the election in 2017 and lost their majority, which was such a bad result.
that some Labour supporting people, including, as we heard there, Noam Chomsky, still think Jeremy Corbyn won. So I suppose there's two things here, Lara. Sometimes the polls are just wrong, as in 2015. They just were overstating Labour support. And sometimes the polls change.
Exactly.
And actually, the Tories did pretty well in the local elections in 2017, which was partly what gave Theresa May the impetus to think that she could call that snap election.
Exactly. So, and I think that's an important distinction because election campaigns, although looking at the number that we've covered, don't seem to have fundamentally changed that many of the elections that we've looked at. They do, and that's an important distinction on the polling. But I think 2015 and 2017, although there are many previous examples of where the polls have been slightly off, 2015 and 2017 are such good examples because, especially when you look at the front page of The Times, they completely shape the way that we covered and thought about those elections up to and including on polling day. If you take 2015 as an example, the idea that the Conservatives would win an outright majority was declared by The Times to basically be, so left field that it wasn't really seriously even considered on the election day paper. And actually, much more important to the coverage of a number of publications ahead of that was who were the power brokers, who were the people that would be negotiating in the circumstances where no party would be clear of a majority, what would happen in those situations. And so it's always fascinating then to read the following edition of the paper, where, of course, everything has changed so quickly. And I think apart from in elections, there aren't really that many examples when, as journalists, we work where one edition of the paper is so markedly different to the next. And it seems like political reality just changes so quickly. And 2015 and 2017 are very good examples of that.
The other counterpoint, I'd say, is the 45 election, where the polls were right and everyone ignored them because polling was still quite in its infancy.
And they ignored the by-elections as well. Yeah. And that's the other thing that is interesting looking at this is that actually I think we do sometimes forget about the significance of by-elections, but they are considered, especially by the Times and the run-up to election, to be another kind of polling in essence. And 45 is a good example of how in the run-up to that.
And also just people now say, oh, it's groupthink or it's herd mentality of the media. You know, that, I mean, it's just human nature that people start all sort of slightly fall into that trap. And sometimes just a good reason for us to check ourselves, I suppose. Right, let's move on then. We are moving on to Lara's lesson number two. Despite all the speculation, prime ministers don't usually go early.
This is, I think, quite an important, or at least the most relevant lesson for today's politics. People in Westminster are obsessed with this question of whether we will see an election in the autumn, whether we could see it as late as January 2025, which is the latest, of course, that we're able to see it.
Is it today or yesterday was the 1 year to go that they have to prorogue Parliament?
Oh, brilliant.
Yeah. So this time next year, we definitely won't have Parliament sitting if there, you know, is the last moment when...
So we are firmly into election year.
Yeah.
Of course, there's a lot of speculation about whether or not Rishi Sunak will go early. There are loads of theories about what the small boats issue means for the logic or otherwise of a possible May poll. Huge amounts of, inches of newspaper columns and stories devoted to this question of whether Rishi will go early. I actually think when you look at the elections that we've covered, there's always been a lot of speculation in the period where you are allowed to pick your election date, it should be said, for people whether or not prime ministers will go early on this. And actually, usually, if you're behind in the polls and if you're behind on the metric of who would make a best prime minister, it's so vanishingly rare that you would take the jump and go for it, let alone if you're 20 plus points behind in the polls. There are some exceptions to this that are quite interesting. The most interesting, I think, is Harold Wilson in 1970. And this is interesting because people were expecting an October election, which is, of course, in some ways what we're expecting now with Rishi Sunak. And Harold Wilson ended up going in June, which he thought would wrongfoot his Conservative colleagues and would lead Labour, who were ahead in the polls at this point, to a victory. So that it's not completely comparable to the current situation. And he lost.
Well, finally, we've got a little clip.
The Conservatives have now gained enough seats to make it extremely likely that they will have an overall absolute majority in the House of Commons, certainly.
To all intents and purposes, you've now given up any hope of...
Well, I think the figures speak for themselves.
And I suppose there's also a difference between, the Boris Johnson obviously went early. He only became Prime Minister in July and then called an election. But the circumstances were very different because of all the Brexit shenanigans and wanting to get Brexit done. And it just doesn't feel like there were some people who think, we could get Rwanda done, could become a new election slope, but it's just not the same thing. The country's not gripped.
No, unless we get ourselves in such a constitutional muddle that it seems kind of essential that we do. But I think Brexit isn't comparable in that way. And again, it's felt pretty irresistible to some people to declare that it's been very, very similar in recent weeks over that Rwanda fight. But I don't think it has quite the same constitutional urgency as 2019. But you're right, the 2019 is a good exception.
Okay, what's Lara's lesson number three?
It hasn't always been about sound bites, is lesson three.
We've got a little clip.
The Britain that is going to be forged in the white heat of this revolution.
And I tell you, education, education, and education.
It is time to get Brexit done.
I said I would stop the boats, and I meant it.
I mean, the interesting thing is, again, it's a reminder that actually sound bites, they go back quite a long way. But I suppose they've just got shorter and shorter and shorter, that maybe a spirited speech becomes a sentence becomes...
Exactly. And I think that the white heat of technology there, which was Harold Wilson, his first time in the 60s, being elected as Prime Minister, that's a good example of a speech that was actually written not with a huge amount of consideration beforehand. I think he stayed up overnight to write it. It was a speech. It wasn't just that little soundbite. But that first administration of Wilson's became so connected to this idea of technology, but also to planning. And then in 70, when he lost, people said, oh, well, it was, partly as a result of the loss of this vision of planning. That was one of the big reasons why we lost. And I'm not sure, actually, if you go back to that time, that would have been exactly how they expected that to go. But definitely this has is deeply connected to the introduction of wireless, to the ways that we begin to cover elections. We see wireless for the first time, I think, in 1931. From then on, obviously, election coverage becomes a bigger thing. But, we did the elections for most of the 19th century. And the interesting thing about that, I think there are two things. First is a lot of speeches in Parliament are very relevant to the election. Parliament, I think, just generally has a bigger part to play during electioneering in this. And that's partly because when people made speeches, not just in Parliament, but then on the campaign trail and the Midlothian campaign by Gladstone in the 1880s is a good example of this. Those speeches in the Times and elsewhere would be covered often in full. So it wouldn't be that journalists like you or I would pick out the most eye-catching of phrases that we thought was a kind of neat summation of what people were saying. But often you would find a huge amount more space for the broader messages of these politicians. And actually, their kind of oratory skills were much more important, I think, to electioneering, at least insofar as, we would cover the full whack of them often.
But it's also a reminder that actually, in the dim and distant past, you could go around the country and basically make the same speech everywhere. But once they start, Gladstone in particular, tailored his speech because he knew the papers like the Times were going to report him every day.
Yeah.
So you had to find a different way of saying I'm good and the other lot of rubbish.
Yeah.
Liberals are great and Disraeli's a nightmare. In order for it to be reported every day. So I suppose that's, and that's essentially what still happens now. That the stump speech needs something else in it. Otherwise it's not gonna be covered. Right, next of Lara's lessons.
The next of my lessons is that parties do usually recover eventually. And I say this because there's a lot of coverage in the Times and elsewhere after those elections that are deemed completely apocalyptic at the time for the party that has had the most serious drubbing. And almost always they make some form of recovery, even if it takes quite a long time.
Okay, so we've got some examples of this. We're going back to 1983 and Michael Foot.
Britain cannot afford to continue with the present policies. We cannot afford to continue with policies of mass unemployment.
And obviously, they then went on to a terrible defeat. The 1983 Labour manifesto dubbed the longest suicide note in history.
Yeah, exactly. And I mean, this manifesto was, I think any of us would look at it now, NATO withdrawal, deep scepticism about membership with Europe, which at the time was, quite polarising, but really a sense that Michael Foot was not a strong Labour leader during this time, that at this point the party was bitterly divided, not just on Europe, but on union relations and other issues as well. And although he was a towering political figure, this was certainly one of the more apocalyptic results for Labour. And after this point in the Times and elsewhere, there were serious reflections about whether or not the Labour Party would ever walk towards being a kind of credible party of government in the future. And many people looking at Foot's leadership of the Labour Party and saying that actually it didn't look like a kind of big national party of government. It looked like a kind of bitterly divided one that at that moment was led by somebody that had views that you would probably consider to be quite on the fringe of what is electorally acceptable to the vast majority of people.
But you're right there. All those apocalyptic predictions about, oh, we might never get into government again. I mean, it did take them 14 years to 97.
Then you had it was a long march.
But then you had the Tories, you know, in 97 wondering if they'd ever get back. Even the Labour Party in 2019, you know, the apocalyptic predictions that Labour would never get close to government. And now, you know, look at the polls now. In fact, talking to 2019 as well, this was, I don't need to remind you, the Lib Dem leader, Jo Swinson, she was going to be Prime Minister, she said, talking after the 2019 election.
This winter election has been dark in more ways than one.
Yeah, it was indeed. She lost her own seat. The Lib Dems are left with just 11 MPs. But, you know, there's a reason why the Lib Dems have been compared to cockroaches that can survive as a nuclear winter. You know, they keep plodding on. And again, you know, now looking like they could make, you know, significant gains like they have done in the by-elections. And actually, William Hague, I thought this was quite interesting for a man who... So he picked up after 97 and the drubbing that the Tories got and all the predictions the Tories might be permanently out of power. Then he was on Times Radio last week, again talking about how the Tories could be permanently out of power.
There's no guarantee of ever coming back. You know, the Conservatives have come back every time in the past for 200 years, but no guarantee. Politics will change a lot over the next 20, 30 years. The world will change a lot.
So it's interesting that he's even leaning into exactly... You're saying, by and large, he's wrong. It's been a long time since we've had a political party disappear.
It's been absent significant splits, right? I think if you look over the last 200 years, it's usually when a great issue divides the party such that there are massive splinters off of it that you would see the final end of it.
Yeah.
But, you know, I think William Hague's prediction there, obviously within the context of a kind of bitter row over this Rwanda bill and a significant portion of his MPs who seem content, at least in his view, to throw the whole thing away, kind of making perfect the enemy of the good in their view over this bill.
It is amazing, actually, when you think it was 100 years this month that the Labour formed their first government.
Yeah.
And just how long the two main parties have endured, despite all the predictions that they would never win. Yeah. Finally, let's talk biscuits. What's your fifth lesson from the archive?
My fifth lesson from the archive, which is obviously relevant to all main party leaders at the moment, is to stay away from women with gingerbread on the campaign trail. And this is because, and unfortunately we don't have audio of this moment, which is really sad, but Gladstone, of course, great...
To be clear, it's not because we can't find it, it's because it predates smartphones.
And much else besides. This is because Gladstone, when he was running for Prime Minister again in 1892 in June, he gave a speech in Chester and he was hit by some gingerbread in his eye by a woman who he described as middle-aged and bony. And he was really upset about this, and it actually lacerated the pupil of his only serviceable eye. So it was pretty serious. He was partly blinded, and I think fortunate, given the eye patch he had to wear around for the remainder of the campaign, that there wasn't a huge amount of filming going on at this time in the late 19th century, because he was wearing, I think, dark mafia-like spectacles and wasn't able to read for a few months. And the interesting thing about this is that in history, we think about it, for those of us who still think about that kind of great act against Gladstone, as being from a woman who didn't like him and wanted to attack him. And actually, there's a letter in the Times the day after this attack from someone in Chester saying, actually, he knows the woman who threw this gingerbread and she actually is really mortified and devastated because she's a Gladstone superfan, basically.
So this
And she didn't mean to throw it.
Frederick Dresser said, Sir, friends of Mr. Gladstone will be glad to know the lady who threw the gingerbread at him in Chester is one of his most ardent supporters. Far from intending to insult him, she only attempted to give some outward expression of her frenzied admiration. I could give you her name and address, but she's so utterly overwhelmed with the consequences of her reckless zeal that it would be cruel to add to her sufferings. Yours truly, Frederick Dressel. It's a great letter. It's a great letter. So that's some top advice there. The polls aren't always right, or at least they can change. Prime ministers don't usually go early. It's not always been about the sound bites. It's never quite as bad as predictions, and stay away from women wielding gingerbread. We're now joined by the Evening Standard's Jack Kessler, who has, and I seem to have played some part in this, become addicted to watching old election night broadcasts.
Good evening and welcome to BBC Television's coverage of this razor's edge, Election 74.
Good evening. Well, it looks like being one of the most exciting election nights ever, with the possibility of a very close result and the prospect of Britain having its first woman Prime Minister at the end of the night.
Good evening and welcome to our election results programme.
Good evening and welcome to election night. It's all over at last. The polling stations closed just a moment ago.
So, Jack, the last time we spoke, you'd watched 1992 to 2019 in reverse order. You went backwards. And you couldn't get enough of it.
Before we start, I think it's important that we blame you for this situation. Well, you and norovirus. Because you gave me the idea.
I didn't give you norovirus.
No, you didn't, to be clear. But you gave me the idea to go back further in time, which I had no intention of doing. And then norovirus gave me 48 hours to start watching 87 because I had nothing better to do.
Yes. So why?
Well, I mean, it's time consuming.
and you had plenty of time on your hands.
Yes, but also it's really fun and Lara's just given some of the grand sweep of history stuff. I'm going to stick purely to trivialities.
Yes.
If I may. So things I absolutely loved. So the name Barney Hayhoe. Every time someone said Barney Hayhoe, and it's just
Who is Barney Hayhoe?
So he was an MP in West. It doesn't really matter who he was. What matters?
He was an MP.
He was an MP. Sorry, should we get? But there's plenty of other amazing stuff. So the Dutch government welcoming Thatcher's election in 79 on the basis that she was the more pro-European prime minister was quite good. But the striking thing is how little changes. So if you wanted to get away from war in the Middle East and an energy crisis at home and a conservative prime minister, or rather leader who wasn't particularly good at communication, you wouldn't necessarily watch either 74 election.
But it's interesting that. So how did it change the way that election nights played out? Because it's all BBC ones you've watched, because they've got this sort of amazing archive. How did it change in terms of technology, in terms of presenters? Did you have favourites?
Well, technology is obviously a big one. The swingometer was literally a piece of felt or something that would move across a wall rather than...
Well, I know all about the swingometer. I've written about it in my book. So it was born in the 50s. David Butler wrote to the BBC. He was a sophologist, mm-hmm. and he wrote to the BBC and said, I've got this idea for a speedometer-type device.
But I won't have any Robert McKenzie erasure.
Well, no, so he then played a part in... But it was David who came up with it.
Mm.
He then attributed it to other people.
So in terms of things moving on, I mean, the extraordinary thing is that for all intents and purposes, women don't exist for a very long time. And when they do, it's very obvious that they're women. So the men are just, they have names and the women are Mrs.
Yeah.
And that's why it occurs to me why all prime ministers basically were Prime Minister or Blair or Callaghan. But Margaret Thatcher was always Mrs. Thatcher. Yeah. And I never quite understood why. And it's just because she was a woman and it was very important to make that clear.
To make that distinction. Do you enjoy watching election nights, Lara?
Yeah, those like I haven't gone back in time.
Oh, you should.
But I am finding it. The more Jack talks about it, I'm thinking I might want to.
They're really good, and because when I was writing the book, I spent a lot of time trying to find like particular things that I knew would happen on election night, and you just get sucked into it, and suddenly you're really, oh, I've got to stay another 10 minutes here because we're going to get the result from North Devon, or and actually some people who I'd never sort of seen before, Marcia Williams, who is Howard Wilson's sort of, you know, I don't know what you call it, Praetorian Guard, special advisor, cropped up a lot. I think it was the 79 election, she was sort of on various panels. It's just sort of people you'd sort of forgotten, people you thought of being so huge, they'd never have sat down on a panel on TV. But of course they did, you know, huge political names, all wanted to be on the TV, trying to set the message for election night.
It's so rich with narrative that you find yourself I'll stay up for, if there is an exit poll, I'll stay up for the exit poll, and then I'll stay up for the first result, wherever that may be. And then you've got to stay in because, oh my God, it turns out that Harold Wilson's actually going to lose. And then there are other things. I promised I would stick to trivialities. So it struck me, I think this was 87, or maybe it was 83, but that David Owen was just too sort of leading man handsome to break the mold of British politics. I think he's still the best looking politician in the country.
He's got great hair.
Tremendous.
But then so is Ben Bradshaw. That's a whole separate thing, who's got the best hair in politics. And what other stats have you been pulling out on this about nobody went from being the minority to having a majority?
It's amazing. We think of our electoral system as, you know, you throw the government out. And it happens a lot, but it not since 1970 has a opposition party where the government has a majority is replaced by another government of a different party with a majority. So we think of, you know, surely it happened in 97, but of course the Tories had lost their majority by the time of the 97 election. Labour had lost their majority long before the 79 election came. So we were talking earlier about Keir Starmer and this 20-point lead and why would Sunak call an election.
That's amazing stuff there. So a government with a majority hasn't been kicked out since 1970?
Essentially, yeah.
That's amazing.
So yeah. So if Starmer achieves a majority of one,
yeah,
he'll be the first opposition leader to do that and kick out another government majority
since 1970.
Since 1970.
Amazing. Are you going to go back further?
So I have started on 1970. So it's funny because obviously it's nice to watch people get younger because the alternative normally happens, except honestly, there's been a mess up in the matrix, and no matter how far back you go in time, Sir Alan Beath does not get younger. And I know that sounds really superficial, and damn it, it is superficial. But I don't know how it happened. It's true, though.
He's Lib Dem MP. Now peer, I think.
Certainly Sir Alan Beath. I don't know whether he's a peer or not.
Yeah. So how far back does it go? How far back could you go?
It certainly goes back to 45.
Yeah.
I fear at some point it may turn into a radio experience.
Well, we'll get you back when you've done another three or four. I accept no responsibility for this addiction. Thank you for listening to Politics Without the Boring Bits. If you've been with us for a while, why not tell your friends about us in person, or better still, do it on social media. It is the perfect Christmas present because it's free. Do get in touch with your thoughts and comments. You can email me, matt@times.radio. But for now, for me, Matt Jolly, it's goodbye.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
So, Robert, tell the people, what's a pretendian?
It's just what it sounds like, Angel, a pretend Indian.
Someone who fakes being one of us?
Someone who impersonates a native.
We're talking about real scammers and con artists.
There are pretendians teaching at universities, pretendians running governments, pretendians in Hollywood.
On our new podcast, Pretendians, we'll tell you the incredible story of these jaw-dropping frauds.
Who are they? Why do they do it? And how the heck do they keep getting away with it?
Listen to Pretendians on Spotify or wherever you get your podcasts.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.